Reckless Dice Podcast, where we discuss Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. This is Episode 2, and I'm your host, Paul Rorschach-Tovia. With me tonight are Jesse Gitzman-Burke.
Hello.
And Dan Crimson Avenger Carrick.
Hello.
So, here we are at our second episode. We're back with another official episode, and I'd like to thank the hundreds of folks who have downloaded our last podcast and feature, or that one guy out there who downloaded it hundreds and hundreds of times.
You're welcome, Paul. I told you if I kept hitting that download button, I told you I would get you to 100. So
I was about to admit it was me.
I thought it was my mom, but then I remembered. And tell her that, you know, that I'm making a podcast. So.
My mom refused to download it. She didn't understand what a podcast was.
So we not only appreciate all the downloads, but we also appreciate the feedback that we've been getting through Twitter and through email and comments on the site. And we are listening to your feedback. A case in point, we're going to actually add a new segment to the podcast tonight called System Spotlight, where we're going to dig into one of the unique mechanics of Warhammer 3rd Edition and kind of dig into it and do some details on it. Should be helpful for not only new people to the system, but veterans as well. So that's the new part of the agenda, but we're going to start things off with the news, and then our main topic tonight is going to be about misconceptions of Warhammer Fantasy 3rd Edition, since it's been out for a year and it's so different from a lot of what you see out there. A lot of people there's some memes that are going on out in the boards and the forums about what Warhammer is and isn't. And then we've actually got some questions from Twitter and from the site and emails that we want to wrap up things with. So we'll just kick things off right into the news. So if you've been following us, if you've been looking at the RSS feed or you're following us through iTunes, you notice that we've actually, that this is our fourth piece of content that we've posted. So we did episode 0, which was kind of our test episode, then episode 1, and then Jesse and a couple of guys last weekend actually released a feature. So just so for clarity's sake, I want to make sure everybody understands that every other week we're going to do episodes. And those are kind of the main part where Dan, Jesse, and I will talk about Warhammer. We'll have our segments. We'll break things down for you. But in between those weeks, we're going to put in some different stuff, either features like what you did, Jesse, or play sessions or things like that.
Yeah, so, really kind of whatever tickles our fancy at that point. Scheduling conflicts or new products or really whatever really makes us excited for that week. And they may not happen every week. But
yeah, whatever gets you giddy, right, Jesse?
Whatever gets Gitzman giddy. That's right.
So again, you know, you're more than welcome to download that stuff. We think it's going to be good content, but it's going to be a little more ad hoc, a little more seat of the pants than the highly produced and official and professional.
That's right. Our sound studio that we record this in is not always available.
Of course, we couldn't get ourselves a British accent, so we unfortunately had to resort to false acting between the UK and the US. But that's okay, cheerios, boys. We'll be getting going right about now. So I'm sorry.
That's not bad, man. Are you in theater?
I am.
You know,
I've been studying Shakespeare. You know,
I'd like to hear our European listeners' response to that now.
Oh yeah, they're gonna hurt me. No, edit that out. Edit it.
No way. That's gold.
All right, so that's kind of what you're seeing in between the episodes, but you're more than welcome to download that and listen to it. Should be some good stuff, but we promise every other week we'll be coming back at you as long as we can with new episodes. So, second up on the news, there's this guy out there called Gitzman who's got this website pretty popular about Warhammer Fantasy 3rd Edition, and he's got all these resources on there, and he's got a new thing on there. Big, huge, super huge, detailed map of the Warhammer
100 world. 100 megabytes. This guy has no life. Oh, my God.
I don't know what you guys are talking about.
If we can only get that guy on the podcast, maybe do an interview or something.
I know.
Well, here, hold on. Let me go get him. I think I've got him here. No, no, I appreciate the plug on that. It's been a lot of fun making that map. I'd first like to point out on the super huge detailed map of the Warhammer Old World is that it is a super huge detailed map. A lot of the original credit for the artwork goes to actually several people. I'll get some of their information up in the show notes. But essentially it's a compilation of loads and loads of Warhammer maps from a whole variety of times that – You know, of course, Warhammer's been around for over 25 years, and during that time, the Warhammer world, as it's known, has sort of changed here and there. Locations have potentially changed, rivers have been renamed, content's been added, some content's been removed. So what I've done is compile as much of that information into one single continuous map as possible, with as much detail as possible, and then also then taken an extra step to it and attempted to update that map with community feedback to be the most current map possible, to, you know, incorporate content from books, to incorporate, everything.
What do you mean, Jesse, by feedback from the community?
So when I first initially created the map, it was a black and white map, and it was, I had not actually generated any unique content for it. And I just put it out there kind of as a weekend project. And what ended up happening is a lot of people pointed out, oh, you know, this is misspelled. The city's here. Oh, you got a weird graphical error here. This stuff's scaled improperly. And people were really getting into providing feedback on how to make this map a tool that they could use for their games. And so I kind of started taking that feedback and making adjustments, and all of a sudden I realized that there's enough people really wanting this and enough people giving active feedback in it that I can actually, you know, continue to make these updates, and people will continue to participate in it. And it kind of has become a community map, which, you know, literally hundreds of people have participated in providing content and feedback for. And I've got guys from all over the world who have said, like, hey, I've got a map, or I've been working on a map that, you know, I don't think you've seen yet because its content's not reflected, or, hey, this book has this castle, you know, positioned on the west side of this river instead of the east side of the river. So, you know, maybe we should fix that. So that's the kind of the level of detail that I've been putting into this. And it's been a blast to make. And then I decided to do a color version, which I just a week ago surfaced with and popped it up on the web. And yeah, Dan, it's 100 meg JPEG wrapped in a PDF.
16 hours of download if you have very slow internet.
Yeah, try and get that one on your
well
phone.
Well worth it. Yeah, exactly.
So one of the
on the iPad.
One of the other things that I saw is that you've got a Google Maps interface on there too.
I did. So I thought it would be super cool to do a Google Maps version of the map, just like kind of in the browser to prevent people from having to actually download it if they just wanted to play with it. And I had no idea how to do Google Maps, but I ended up hooking up with a guy from Poland who is was absolutely fantastic. I posted on some random forum saying, hey, I have a map, but I don't know how to do Google Maps. And he responded the next day, I need a map, but I know how to do Google Maps. And I said, well, dude, we are like two peas in a pod now. So him and I and a buddy from his work got together, and over the internet we just kind of exchanged code, exchanged ideas, and eventually surfaced with what you guys see now. And then we have kind of tweaked its design style a bit to fit my site better. But he was instrumental in making that happen. I'll give him a shout out in the show notes as well.
Now how many hours did this take you? Can I just ask a brief?
I think I'm estimating somewhere between 350 and 400 hours, which I'm really embarrassed to say.
Oh my god!
The Photoshop file on this thing, I didn't know that Photoshop had a restriction on its PSD files that once you went over 2 gigabytes, you had to change the file format to a large format Photoshop file. So I actually discovered the PSB file, which does not, or has a much, much more ridiculous limit. But anyway, the uncompressed Photoshop file is just shy of 6 gigabytes. So it takes about 15 minutes to save.
You did an amazing job, man. It looks awesome.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Hey, on your site, so we'll make sure we got a link in the show notes to your site.
Oh, it's gitsmansgallery.com for easy.
Can you do the Google Maps in full screen, or is it?
So the full screen option is not available yet. Actually, coincidentally, the initial code that I worked with was meant for full screen and was designed as such, but I wanted to have it kind of within the framework of my site. And a lot of the comments on the Fantasy Flight forums, Daka Daka and Warseer and a few others have been making requests for a full screen version. So I'll definitely be doing that in the near future. What we've also added to it was the ability to measure distances and also plot a course from city to city, and it'll even calculate how long it'll take you to travel that, not only its distance. So if you say you run 5 miles an hour and you travel for 8 hours a day, it takes you this long to get from Altdorf to Middenheim.
Awesome.
So it's pretty cool. It's all built within the browser.
Very cool.
Well, fun stuff. Awesome. So, you guys feel free and check it out. It's there's a big old link at gitsmansgallery.com on the homepage.
Cool. All right. So the last thing that we've got up is we mentioned at the last podcast that Witch's Song was on the boat. So since the last podcast, the Fantasy Flight has announced that Witch's Song is in stores.
Not my stores.
Yeah, unfortunately, the stores that they're in are not in the areas that any of the Reckless Dice crew live in.
Hey, my store had it.
It did?
I just didn't get it, but yeah.
Oh, Dan.
I know. I passed it on the shelf. I know. Slap my wrist.
I called like three shops around town, and none of them had it yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. I've got two shops that I go to around here, and they're all like, come back this weekend, come back Friday. We're getting a big shipment then. Mm-hmm. So, but I will say, if you go back to the previous episode, I was right. Jesse was wrong.
Oh.
This is an adventure. With the Hedge Magic, not a Hedge Magic expansion with an adventure. So.
Yes. That's okay. But, actually, that sounds like more fun.
Yeah, but what we're hearing on the boards is that it is good. So we'll definitely get a hold of that and maybe do an interstitial, maybe do a feature next week. If not, we'll definitely be covering it in the next episode.
Yeah, that sounds like fun.
You could do your Vanna White unboxing.
I was thinking, actually I thought about maybe we could do an unboxing and an initial impressions feature. It could be fun.
Yeah, then we just have to start doing video, and then I'd have to shave
then we gotta shoot
and put
your
on pants.
Get a hand model.
I
dropped a glass or it exploded in my hand or something, and I cut up my hand, so I'm out. I'm no good. Got a big old crooked Band-Aid on me.
All right. On that note, so we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, our new segment about System Spotlight. And we're back. So we've got a new segment here about System Spotlight. So Warhammer Fantasy 3rd Edition, one of the things that in my experience is that the game mechanically is very, very different from any other RPG that's out there. I mean, there's bits and pieces that you can pull and that you've seen have been influenced by other games that are out there. But really, in the sum total of it, it's definitely a different beast from anything out there, let alone second edition Warhammer. But Dungeons and Dragons, Storyteller, Fate, Fudge, whatever you want, a Pathfinder, all that stuff, this is really different. So what we're going to do, starting with this episode and throughout the next couple of episodes, is we're going to take one mechanic from the system and kind of dig into it and give you a view on what that is, how it works, and it's for new people and it's for veterans as well. And the you're welcome.
I appreciate the new gamer comment. Thank you.
So the one thing that jumps out at you when you start playing Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition is the dice. And it's really very, very unique to the system. There really isn't anything else out there quite like it. Now, there are aspects of it, because what it is that Warhammer Fantasy 3rd has dice pools, which is different from the majority of games that are out there, like your Dungeons and Dragons and Savage Worlds. They're kind of a roll and then a target number idea. So you roll a die and you add that to modifiers and your skills and things like that.
Pretty much the D100 system.
Exactly. Well,
the D20 system.
The D100, the D20, all of those things are kind of a roll and add type system. Whereas you've got, and usually that's one die with Dungeons and Dragons, it's a D20 with Savage Worlds or the Cortex system. That's variable dice depending on how good you are. You roll a D12 if you're great at something, a D4 if you suck at something.
But in essence, generally what you do is in those games, you make a calculation, a mathematical calculation in your head or on paper, however you do it, and determine your target number and then attempt to roll it.
It requires math. Exactly. Yeah, that's the piece.
and then there's a black and white result. You've made it or you haven't.
Right, exactly. So you've either hit the target number and there's a measure of success, maybe you hit 5 over the target number or 10 over the target number, or you went underneath it. So that usual, that one die plus add thing is pretty standard for role-playing games. The other thing is a dice pool, so you actually roll multiple dice. This is similar to games systems like Fate and Fudge and the Storyteller system, where you take multiple dice and you roll them, and then you take those dice either tell you success or failure. For example, the storyteller system, the vampire werewolf, changeling, what's the spirit guy's system? Anyway, with that one, you roll D10s, and for every 7 or greater you get on the D10, that counts as a success. And you have to hit a certain number of successes to be successful at your action. The fate/fudge system, they actually roll D6s or special fudge dice, where if it's a 1 or 2, it's a failure, if it's a 3 or 4, it's neutral, and a 5 or 6 is a success. So you roll a certain number of D6s, and then you have a certain number of pluses and minuses, you add those up, add them to your skills, and it's whether you hit the target or not. But what Warhammer does is it takes the pool system. You roll multiple dice, but they're custom dice. Instead of having any numbers on the dice, they have symbols on there. And there's actually 9 different symbols that are on these dice.
So Dan, being the newest to Warhammer roleplay, what was your impression first time you saw the GM toss the dice on the table and start to explain to you what that all meant?
I thought it was awesome. I mean, from the stance of, you know, I didn't have to use math because unfortunately I really hate math. You know, I really like this system because it helped the GM elaborate more on the story. You know, because when you roll a D20, a D100, there's not really that much avenue of, oh yeah, okay, you made it. Okay, yeah, you failed it. For instance, with my pit fighter trying to jump over a wall, out of a pool of 12 dice that I rolled 0 success and 11 banes. So, apparently my pit fighter just ran smack dab into the wall. So, guess the guy couldn't jump, but it was awesome because, you know, it gave more detail into the game. And again, this system allows a lot more interest, with how you roll, as opposed to what avenue the GM will take your character. And that's one of the cool things that I like about this system is that no single dice roll will ever be the same. And it allows you to elaborate more for the GM on the story. So your guy could be like this awesome, awesome guy. You roll bad and, oh great, he tries to whip out his sword and he pops off his belt and his pants fall. You know, I mean, there's so many
apps. I haven't used that yet.
Yeah, well, I mean, just, there's so many things that allow this system to just evolve the story. And that's one of the great things I like about it. So
we should probably go over what the various dice are and what their intended functions are, because there's been a lot of requests to make sure for people who aren't familiar with a specific aspect of the game, or maybe even people who don't play the game, to kind of familiarize them with the concept of how this dice system is intended to work.
Yeah, the ones I can say, the successes, good. The banes, bad. Okay, more successes, that's good.
But that's actually one of the subtleties of the system is that there are good dice and there are bad dice. So it isn't a case where the good dice are always going to be beneficial to the person who's rolling. If the player's rolling, then it's beneficial to the player. If the GM's rolling, it's beneficial to the NPCs. The bad dice are always going to be bad. So unlike, like I mentioned with the fudge dice have both good and bad based on it. You make things better by adding more good dice. You make things harder by adding more bad dice. So looks like 5 types of good dice. I got that right? Yeah, there's 5 types of good dice. Mm-hmm. There's the blue D8 characteristic dice. There's the red and green D10 dice, the reckless and conservative dice. There's the yellow D6 expertise die. There's the white D6 fortune die. So all those things are how you represent your abilities and statistics and skills when you roll the dice. And they only have good things on them. They only have successes or boons or the critical successes, which is the Sigmar's Comet.
I'd like to add the one caveat to that is that the D6 fortune die also can double as a GM tool to add positive environmental factors to the role. Yeah. So they are influenced by the player and purely benefit the player, but they are not always determined by the player.
For an example, what would you say, Jesse? I mean, being that you've GM'd before, what would you use that fortune dice to explain
to
a new
gamer? Let's pretend your pit fighter is fighting a beastman Gore, and you have the upper hand by being having an elevated position over the Gore. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a perfect example where you would, all things else being equal, where you're rolling your attack dice and he has whatever his defense is that's influencing your pool, I could add a white die to your roll, giving you that slight edge of having the upper or the elevated position over him. Gotcha. Or perhaps You know, if you attack somebody from behind, that might be an opportunity to add an extra white dice or two. And I think we even have some questions specific to that later in the podcast where they're asking for some creative ways to make these dice really do some cool stuff.
Right. So that is so that you're absolutely correct about the fortune die, and then its counterpart is the misfortune die,
which is awesome.
Which is the black D6.
I hate and that
then,
die.
And then the challenge die, which is a purple D8. There's five good dice and two bad dice, but the point that you made there, Jesse, is very important. So in other systems, you can modify the difficulty by, you know, for example, with Dungeons and Dragons, you add five to the target number or stuff like that. You know, if it's harder or you give the player plus five, you know, to their roll. With Warhammer, what you do is you add more dice. You never really take away dice. Mm-hmm. Dice never really cancel each other out, but you always add more dice. So like you said, if there's a combat advantage, if you're on higher ground, you get a fortune die.
I mean, here's an example where, like, Dan, your pit fighter, to incorporate both the fortune and misfortune dice into a roll, you know, your pit fighter has his pool from his statistics, and I give you your negative dice modifiers based on who you're attacking and what skills you're using. But let's say you have the upper ground, so I toss in a white fortune die, but let's also say it's raining, and so I'll also add a black misfortune die. I don't negate the two by not doing either. I add them both to the pool to kind of add that extra bit of color for the environment, you know, the physical attributes of the environment, but also, you know, the weather effects.
Yeah, which is kind of cool with this system. I mean, that's why these dice allow you to really get an in-depth view of the story. And that's one of the reasons why I'm hooked on this RPG. It's just, it is, because, I mean, when you're able to involve so many different types of characteristics, environment, atmosphere, you know, everything that would be wanted in a regular story, and you're able to bring that to life through the dice, it just makes the story so much better. I mean, it's better than saying, oh, you successfully made it. Oh, you failed.
Hey, Paul, can you go over kind of what each of the dice, their kind of intended use is? You know,
sure.
Like the characteristic dice, those have a very specific, you know, purpose. They are called the characteristic dice. And how does that work?
So I think we already kind of covered the fortune and misfortune dice. So those are kind of the little modifications. They're the GM's fiat of the role primarily.
And I'd like to throw out there, feel free and use them. There doesn't always have to be a justified reason. I mean, throw a couple misfortune or fortune dice based on how you feel the scenario is going. You don't need to really be, oh my God, do I really need to only add one or can I add two? Is it going to make or break the role?
Or
they're meant to
the
add
guy.
Flavor.
Or if you just like the guy, just throw in six misfortune dice.
Mm-hmm.
The designers were very, very specific in not saying this is one misfortune die, this is one fortune die. They just basically leave it up to the GM and they say, you know, you play the game that you want to play. If you want to add fortune dice or misfortune dice to this role because of this or that, totally up to you.
It's kind of that meta approach to the game where they just don't get into the nitty gritty aspects of what you're doing. Yeah. It's really, we're here to make the action happen. You're going to have your experience. You're going to enjoy yourself. You're going
to leave it to you. And that's the great thing about it.
So back to what the dice are. So the blue D8s, the characteristic dice, those represent your raw character ability, right? So your strength, toughness, agility, willpower, fellowship. And what's the last one? What I missed?
I don't have it in front of me. How embarrassing. Right. We might need to cut this part out.
All you're fired.
Essentially what that pool does is it allows you, it is the foundation of your character. Nothing's right. Those dice are directly attributed to what your character's physical abilities or mental abilities are. And then the rest of the dice available to you to build your pool will help modify that pool and help it grow. It's your foundation to build on. It's the first dice you're going to pull out to build your pool.
So if you're swinging a sword, mm-hmm. You're rolling your strength. If you've got three strength, your dice pool starts with three characteristic dice. It's a one for one relationship.
And you'll notice very conveniently the shape and color of your character sheet. All those little boxes you filled your numbers in actually do represent or reflect the shape or style of dice that you should be rolling corresponding to it.
Yep.
So, you know, just a little tip to the designers on that. They did a nice job there.
So the other two types of dice are that I want to talk about next are the conservative and the reckless dice. So this is a different aspect, and will probably have its own system spotlight on how you change your stance in Warhammer 3rd Edition, which is a whole other thing that we can get into and spend a lot of time on. But basically, the more reckless you become, or the more conservative that you go, you exchange one for one your characteristic dice for the conservative and reckless dice. And from a probability standpoint, you always want to do that. The more reckless dice that you roll, the better off than if you roll an equivalent number of characteristic dice.
Correct. Yeah, so the characteristic dice have no negatives to them whatsoever. It is only positive. You're only going to have successes or boons generated by rolling them. The alternative is the conservative and reckless, which have a higher degree of successes or positive effects available per roll, but also add the potential for a slight negative. And Paul, maybe you want to get into the difference between the conservative and the reckless dice.
Right. So the conservative dice, so from just a probability standpoint, you basically have a 1 in 2 chance of having a success being rolled on the characteristic dice. For the conservative dice, you have basically a 7 in 10 chance of getting at least one success on a conservative die, and you have a 6 in 10 chance on the reckless dice. Now, there's actually double successes that you can get on the reckless dice and things like that, but just from a pure success versus no successes, you always want to roll conservative or reckless. But the side effects that come into play, so these other symbols that are on the dice out of the 9 that we're talking about, specifically on the conservative side, there's a delay symbol that can happen on some of the rolls.
Mm-hmm.
And the delay will actually kind of slow things down, because the intention is that you're taking your time. You're calling your shot. You're
picking the lock, and it took longer than you expected.
Right. You're the calm in the storm. You know, you're not in the berserker mode. You're the Legolas, not the Gimli.
Mm-hmm.
to go after Lord of the Rings. Whereas conversely, the reckless dice is you're kind of going full on. You're just, you know, caution to the wind, heading out there. And there actually is a chance that you'll get a negative side effect, from that, as well as fatigue or stress yourself out.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's a good way to describe it, where you have kind of the ability to take your time with very few detriments, or you just go balls out and you have a chance of hurting yourself a little bit.
And that all.
Now, I'd like to make a one rules clarification for some of the guys out there, and one that initially confused me a lot regarding the reckless dice. The little blood drop symbol is the indicator for suffering from fatigue when you roll. And it's not uncommon to roll multiple reckless dice in a roll. So let's say a strength, an attack roll with a strength of 4, you may be rolling 3 reckless dice and 1 characteristic die amongst your other dice. If you roll more than 1 fatigue, you still only suffer 1 fatigue point. You do not suffer the number of fatigue points equal to the number of blood drops you roll. Still, it's as you only suffer 1. And that was something that was easily overlooked in the rules.
And the clarification on that, too, is that if you're rolling a physical characteristic, or if it's a physical test, if you're rolling strength, toughness, or agility, you gain fatigue by the drops.
Correct.
If you're doing intelligence, that's the one
I
missed,
good point.
Willpower, or fellowship. Then you gain 1 stress. And the same thing with your conservative dice, the delay, the hourglass symbol. Multiple hourglass symbols just means that you're delayed once, not delayed multiple times.
So now, Paul, by delay, I mean, especially since, you know, I don't think I've ever rolled one of those dice, what would a GM use that to really kind of...
The two things that are in the rules is that you can either add extra recharge to any of the cards that you have out there. So any of the actions that you've used, you won't get to use them again. Or you get bumped down in the initiative order.
The bump down in the initiative is the one that I've most commonly used, in a combat encounter, at least.
Now, why is that, Jesse?
Because I forgot about the other one.
But if you take like one of their defensive actions and throw two recharge dice on that, then it's the time for the beastman to swing back, and you can't dodge because you got delayed from that, and that was the effect. That's pretty damaging too. So I find those delays
to be much more creative when you're actually doing more of the story the story content, when you pick the lock and it takes longer than expected because you're in a rush, or you're running away or sneaking and the bad guy gets a little further away than you wanted him to, or there's cool things like that that are much easier to tie in into the narrative aspects of the story.
So the last good die that I want to talk about is the yellow D6 die, which is the expertise die. So this is the die that you roll if you're actually trained in the skill that you're doing. So if you're trained in weapon skill, combat's the easy example. If you're trained in weapon skill, you get to roll one yellow D6. Mm-hmm. And the unique thing is, there's two unique things about the D6, the yellow D6, the expertise die, is that it has an exploding symbol on it. So there's
dangerous.
Actually a hammer plus. And the hammer with a plus, if you get that, you get to roll the yellow die again. So you can build up a lot of successes if you roll well.
I just like the bane with the plus because it means righteous success. Righteous. I love
that's,
it.
Yes, that is the official term, is a righteous success. That means that you get to reroll that die.
Righteous.
Righteous.
And then the other thing is that the critical success is only on that die as well, which is the twin-tailed common of sigma. Mm-hmm.
So that's the only way to generate a critical hit without actually generating a sufficient number of boons through a normal attack. This kind of gives you a critical hit right off the bat if you want, or you can activate one of your abilities on your card.
Right. So let me lay out the symbols, just straight up. So the hammers are successes, and they are their antithesis are the challenges, which are the cross swords. Mm-hmm. So you roll your dice pool, you count the number of hammers you got, and then you subtract the number of cross swords that you have. If you've got any hammers left over, you've succeeded at your test.
Full stop. I mean, that's the core element of the dice rolls. Are there more hammers than swords? You've succeeded. If there are less hammers than swords, also zero, you've failed. And then the rest is to add color.
And everything else is a side effect. It does not affect whether you succeed or fail. So
zero successes and 100 boons is still a failure.
Mm. It's still a failure, but it's a good side effect. So you can fail with good side effects, and you can succeed with bad side effects.
Or you can fail and just slam into a wall like I did. So.
Exactly.
I did it with style, okay?
Sure, you popped your head through the other end.
I did, man.
So the most common side effects are what we've been talking about, is the boons and the banes. So the boons are the imperial eagles and the banes are the skulls. So it's the same thing as successes and challenges. You count the number of eagles that you've got, you subtract the number of skulls that you got, and then so you either have more banes than boons or more boons than banes. And then depending on what the ruling is or what your action card says, certain side effects take effect.
For example, if you have a net of two banes, you can activate there. Your GM can activate the effect of forcing the character to suffer a fatigue or stress point.
Right, that's the universal effect. Mm-hmm. So two boons is you regain fatigue or stress. Two banes is you suffer fatigue or stress. But then on your action cards, again, something we'll talk about in a future system spotlight about the lines on that. There's different side effects depending on the action that you're doing.
Now, I have a rules clarification question for you, Paul. Something I've been confused on. So let's say I make my roll and I've got two banes up on the table, and I have an action card that I used that has an effect to leverage those banes. Do I suffer the fatigue point and the effect on the card, or is it only one or the other?
I can't, it is only one or the other. So
you do just kind of essentially take your dice and start applying it to an effect, but the universal effect of the suffer one fatigue or bane is always available if there's nothing else to apply.
That's correct. Okay. And we're kind of getting into the resolution stuff, but it's the successes are only the best success that you can take, but boons and banes, you can activate multiple side effects by paying for it. So if you get five boons on a roll, you can spend two of those boons to do the universal effect of getting back one fatigue, and then use another three boons to activate your critical hit capability, mm-hmm. your CR on your weapon, or things like that as well.
Cool. And yeah, just to clarify, to activate your critical hits, it is the number of boons you generate, not the number of successes you generate, which was
absolutely
an initial confusion for me for a little bit.
Yep. Now, I have a quick question. The purple die, now if you ever get the chaos symbol, does mm-hmm. that correlate to, now what if you're not facing anything with chaos? Is that, you know...
It's chaos is
everywhere.
the chaos symbol is just the critical fail, just like the Sigmar's comment is the critical success. So there are going to be special rules for that. So if you're casting a spell, for example, that's when you go to the miscast deck. A lot of your actions have those critical fail lines on them that show exactly what you do. There's no universal effect, so it's really up to the GM to determine what happens. And one of the things that was clarified for me in the guides that wasn't quite so clear in the other rules was that they don't cancel each other out. You can have a comet and a star, and they both take effect.
So now what if there's no eligible effects? Does it count as a bane, you're saying, for the chaos star?
There are universal effects. I was mistaken. So it can always count as a bane. If there's nothing else that the GM wants to bring up for you.
There should always be something the GM should come up with.
And then the comet, can either count as a boon or a success, either or. And that's up to the player if they don't have a specific effect that they want to activate.
And the last two are the delay and the exertion, which are the two side effects of the conservative and reckless dice that we've kind of already covered.
Yeah. So the cool thing is, and we kind of touched on it, is that by looking at the results of each of the dice, you can see what part or what aspect of the character or what the situation is that actually did the success mm-hmm. or the failures mm-hmm. or the side effects. So if you roll a challenge on a misfortune die, well, maybe you slipped because it was muddy. If you roll successes on your reckless dice, then that means because you went, you know, full on berserker mode, then you surprised the guy and that's how you got through.
Yeah, or maybe if you succeeded or failed based on a fortune die, it was pure luck that you succeeded, not your inherent skill.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Or lack of luck.
So if you take a little time, if you don't just roll and say, okay, you succeed and here's what happens, or you fail and here's what happens, if you actually take a little time to put a little bit of story and color into your die rolls as a player even, not even necessarily as a GM, you know, you're really starting to get into that mode of role playing, R-O-L-E playing, as opposed to role playing, R-O-L-L playing, right?
Or LARP, right?
Yeah, well, I think once you start pulling out the fake British accents, then you're down the path of LARPing.
We don't know anybody who does that, right, Dan?
No. What are you talking about?
What ho?
All
right, so I think we've put a fork in that one. I think we've talked enough about dice.
And I know we're gonna touch a little bit on some of that in the Q&A section as well, with some specific examples.
So we're gonna take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about misconceptions.
Ooh.
Okay, we're back, and we're going to get into our main topic here, which are the misconceptions of Warhammer 3rd Edition. So if you've been out there on the boards, if you've looked out there, a lot of people have gotten certain ideas in their head, not necessarily from play, but from just seeing things or seeing play or reading other posts on the site about these ideas of what Warhammer 3rd Edition is about. So I've got kind of a laundry list here, and I'm going to kind of run down them and just talk about each one of them, you know, just maybe a little Mythbusters. Is this right? Is this wrong? What are, you know, where's it coming from?
I think you mean confirmed.
Yes.
Yes. That's right.
You can neither confirm nor deny, right?
No.
Mythbusters.
Don't go too far there, else we're gonna owe somebody licensing somewhere or
it's
something.
Plausible.
That's true.
Yeah, I don't want any. I don't want any lawyers calling me or anything.
No TMing. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So I think the first one I want to start out with, because we kind of covered it last segment, is that the dice are too confusing.
Okay. Can I jump in on this one?
Yeah, go for it, dude. I think
being a new player, if you have a guide in front of you, the dice are not confusing. The dice are your friend. Okay. The great thing about it, as we stated prior, the dice are really a way of telling the story. And as you said, there's very simple breakdown. So for anybody that says the dice are too confusing, you need to go through preschool again to understand colors, color coordination. Okay. It's for someone,
you know,
new,
I think
I've never played an RPG. Jesse, you know, I have never played.
I do know. And Dan, you are very, very slow.
Yes, I am. I told you I got dropped as a child a few times. Leave me alone. But being a new player, that was the one first thing I thought, oh my God, I'm horrible at math. I can't do this. But when you roll the dice and you're like, oh, okay, let's see. I got a success.
Not to contradict you, Dan, but when I first opened up the dice, I was a little intimidated by, and maybe it's just my roots with old school RPGs, where I said, oh my God, this is strange. And that was probably the intimidating part, is that it was so different, not so much the basic functionality of it. Cause once I got using it, it exploded with just the possibilities and creativity and how easily it just flowed. I love it.
But there is a bit of a learning curve.
There's
9 symbols you got to learn. There's 7 dice that you got to learn, but once you get that down, then you can do anything.
Exactly.
And you don't need to do math.
No, it's a great resource for GMs. I mean, honestly, I think that this one characteristic of having these types of dice allows the GM just substantial amounts of directions that they can take the story. And that is the great thing, is that you're not going to play something, you know, from straight out of a book and okay, you.
Well, I have certainly had, I've let the dice dictate the encounter. I mean, like, I have a broad idea of what I'd like to accomplish in a game, but a lot of times I've let the dice just kind of drive it a bit and allow it to kind of meander within the framework I've set it. And that I've had a lot of success doing that. And it if you're not afraid to kind of just let the dice handle it for a while, it'll take you in directions you didn't anticipate, which can be a lot of fun.
And it's great, Jess. I mean, it makes the game that more palatable. You just want more, you know. It's like, oh God, I can't wait for my next roll, because I want to see if I'm gonna hit the wall again or if I'm actually gonna get over it. You know, it adds another key element to
the
story.
Are you telling me your fighter tried again?
Yeah, I failed again. So let's just leave it at that.
All right,
thump.
So the next one we've got up is, and this is probably the most common one, maybe not so much recently, but definitely when I first started out, is that it's a board game.
Mm-hmm. I could understand
that. Because it came from Fantasy Flight, and Fantasy Flight are known for their board games. They're excellent board games and living card games, things like that. It came in a huge box, you know, a board game kind of sized box for $100.
Yeah.
Right. That's kind of the going
price. I'm not used to role-playing
games
coming in boxes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that really kind of stuck for quite a while, that no, this isn't an RPG. This is a board game. And honestly, you know, once you dig into it, it is an RPG. There's nothing about, I mean, there are some hybrids that are out there, you know, your Call of Cthulhu's, your Ravenloft's, things like that, you know, your Space Hulks, right? Where there's, you know, there's role-playing aspects, but it's on the board and it's a limited area. This is a full-blown RPG. You know, you get past all the cards, you get past the dice, everything like that. It's the community storytelling that you're doing, the free-form community storytelling that you're doing, that's the hallmark of any RPG. And you just have to get past the physicality of it to recognize that that's what it is.
I think I tend to agree with you exactly. You covered it perfectly.
So the next one I've got is, well, it's geared towards MMO or casual players, right? This is the 4th edition.
So what's the reference to MMO? Because I don't fully follow you on that one.
Actually, I
know what an MMO is, but I meant the what relationship does this kind of have to an MMO, or where are the similarities there?
Can I ask a question? Because MMO, I have no idea. What is
it? It's
an MMO.
So massively multiplayer online game.
World
right?
of Warcraft.
Oh, sorry, I never played WoW.
Right, yeah.
He knows WoW, but not MMO. I love it.
So I think where this comes from is one of the aspects of the game, which is the action card system. So the idea, because okay, when you play World of Warcraft, right, the computer game, you have certain skills and abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And you click on that ability and it runs and then it cools down and then you click on the ability again and that's how you swing.
I see where you're going with it. Okay.
Like that. So I understand where this misconception is coming from. And then from the casual side of things, right, the idea is that Warhammer 3rd does not have a huge amount of charts and tables and crunch, you know, to it. I mean, there's crunchy aspects to the rules, but it's not a traveler. It's not, you know, you don't have to look up on the treasure tables of what it is, and you don't have, you know, your XP level at this level, you're gonna have 4,000 XP, you go to this level. Mm-hmm.
So for the first two that we've already covered, they've been busted. But I think this one to me is plausible.
Yeah. Well,
this one has some merit to it, but not a lot.
But what's the problem with expanding the base instead of...
Exactly. Well, I think what they've done is they've allowed for the accessibility of the game to be a little bit more approachable without really sacrificing the content of the game. They haven't dumbed it down. They've just re-presented it in a more approachable manner to maybe expand the audience and get some more people into role-playing.
Yeah. So the next one I've got is, it's too expensive.
Mm-mm. Player's Guide. Sorry.
It's not that much more expensive than any other role-playing game. It may be a little bit, but the quality of content you're getting for your money is superb. Is higher at the same time. So I guess there might be a little legitimacy to the fact that it is more expensive than a standard role-playing game if you were to go out and buy all the content just like you would in the other one, but.
Yeah. Well, as Paul stated in the first episode, if you know you're going to be gaming with a huge group, then of course, $99, you're going to buy the GM book, get everything that's usable for everybody that's within the group. But if you're a person like me and you already know there's going to be a GM, the player's guide, and then the character's vault, you're not spending that much money.
Let's face it. I mean, anybody who's playing these kind of games, any gamer that exists, especially role-playing gamers, especially Warhammer, Games Workshop, tabletop gamers, we are enthusiast hobbyists. We are not casual people who play these games. We play these games because we really like them and we will pay for what we want.
How much does it cost to get a 40k army nowadays?
Yeah, exactly. You're easy dropping $300-$400. Yeah. I mean, we are willing to pay the money for a hobby that we enjoy.
I was doing it to get the girls. I don't know about you guys, but
totally.
All right, for the next one, I'm going to kind of combine two things here. It's the general concept that there isn't enough fluff out there, or that there aren't enough careers, there isn't enough stuff out there. You know, the portions are too small and the food tastes horrible.
Wow,
so.
I'm not sure
I don't agree about the enough fluff.
Well, I think if you I think that argument generally comes from people who are coming in from the second edition, where the books had a little more meat to them. And I think that they're coming in here and seeing that it's largely rules or guidance on how to play, and a little less on the fluff aspect. But I think if you look at beyond the core rules, if you look into either the new books that have come out or any of the modules that have come out, there's a lot of fluff in there. That's actually they may have condensed it down to like digestible portions, but it's good stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, also you're playing in the Warhammer world. Come on. There's so much fluff.
But let's just say for the people who don't know the Warhammer world, like let's say Paul, who came in specifically for the RPG, not knowing the Warhammer world ahead of time, like you and I did, he has the internet and then he has these books that he's purchased to go off of.
I understand.
And, I would tend to, there is some legitimacy to the, if you were to compare the direct amount of fluff you'd get from previous editions, but I don't think the amount of fluff you're getting now is insufficient.
It may
be inferior to prior editions, but it's not insufficient.
And I think from the careers aspect, I mean, right now, not counting Witch's Song, we've got 60 careers out there.
I was going to say, I mean, let's compare this to like any other role-playing game where you're a fighter, a cleric, or a rogue, or a wizard, right? I mean, these careers are, there's so many, I can't imagine somebody even building an argument on that. Yeah. There may not be sufficient, advanced careers at this time. I think the base careers are fantastic. They're still missing a couple, but it's nothing that's going to break the game. It's, but the advanced careers I do feel a little bit restricted just because I want to see, I want my card that shows that I can be a, who knows what, a giant slayer.
Or, Arch lector versus, yeah, you know, versus what, a priest, yeah.
Yeah, or like the 10 different versions that a
slayer battle lizard,
a slayer can advance through, you know, that kind of stuff, which is always fun. But I do feel that they have really a nice broad place to play in.
Cool.
I think people are stuck into that concept of I'm going to go from level 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 20. And this game is just not meant to be a leveling up game. This game concentrates on actually playing a character and having fun for this, for the actual story, and less for the system of grinding. And well, the character professions really lend to that, where you are progressing slower and you're progressing. A third career character is like the equivalent of a level 20 character. This is not a level 3 character.
Well, and it's the Warhammer way, right? Is that the rat catcher, you know, through luck and skill and fate, winds up saving the emperor.
Right.
You know, kind of idea. These are people, when you start out, you know, you're at that common set for the most part.
Yeah.
And you become great throughout your actions, not because you've gone up a level.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. The next one that I've got is, it's too easy to hit in combat.
Well, it's not too easy to run over a wall, but.
Yeah, I mean, come on, you know, but it all depends upon the GM. I mean,
you know, I've seen some really big dice pools being generated by some fighting classes, and there is some legitimacy to this one as well. I think it's hit or miss depending on the actions you've chosen, the talents you've chosen, how your party's organized, and if you have any spells on you. But
I also think that if you look at some of the higher level or higher threat monsters mm-hmm. that are out there, you know, there's a lot of defensive options that those monsters have. And even if you hit, right, you may, based on the toughness and the soak mm-hmm. of the thing that you're hitting, since you're doing a static amount of damage,
you'll always do at least 1 point.
You're only mm-hmm. you're always doing at least 1 point, but maybe you're only doing 2 or 3 points
right.
on a beast that's got 25.
Well, I'd also like to throw in there that I think that this is actually on purpose. I think that you are meant to hit often. And the thing is, it's meant to keep the game moving. I think you're going to hit often, and the amount of damage you do is going to vary significantly, but it keeps the combat flowing. It keeps damage being dealt. It constantly tips the battle in one person's favor or the other, and you will very rarely ever hit a actual stalemate in combat where I missed, you missed, I missed, you missed. Oh my god, is somebody going to hit? This is killing me.
And I've honestly,
done that in D&D a dozen times, and it's awful.
And honestly, do you want to sit in a combat for 3.5 hours to just kill one creature and then great? Oh look, there's another one. You know,
one thing they've done in this game is they keep it moving and they keep it steady the entire time. I rarely have any downtime where you're not doing something exciting, and it allows you to get a hell of a lot more story in a game session than I have in any other game system.
And the last point that I want to make is that, yeah, you may be a combat god and you're always hitting, but are you generating enough of the side effects and the successes to do more damage, to do the critical hits as opposed mm-hmm. to just the normal hits?
Yeah, three damage, or are you doing some crazy stuff?
Right. Are you doing 3 damage every round against a guy that's got, you know, 24 wound threshold? Okay, 8 rounds later, you finally killed him.
Crippled the rest of your group.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Or are you busting out the critical hits? Are you busting out the, you know, the +2 damages and things like that? That's... Yes, exactly.
Righteous.
So I think the last
one
is...
It's the guy from Finding Nemo, if nobody caught that.
Exactly.
The last one that I've got here is the bits detract from the role-playing. I've got... My personal opinion on this is that it kind of goes back to the casual question. By having everything out in front of you, it keeps the game moving. You're not as worried about the mechanics because the mechanics are there. It's, you know, you're just referencing them from what's in front of you, from what you see in front of you, and it gives you more time to actually role play your character.
What I've found is I decided that I immediately after opening up the game went out to Walmart and bought a couple bags of glass beads.
You shop at Walmart? I'm just kidding.
When I have to. and I bought some glass beads in order to replace all the little triangle markers. And really, I thought they were too small, and they weren't great to handle. They didn't really have that, the weight to them that I would expect. So I went and got some red ones for fatigue, some blue ones for stress, some white ones for fortune, you know, and so forth. And that was a great way to give the bits you're referring to a little more, a little higher quality. And that's tough to do with Fantasy Flight stuff, I think, usually. But I think it was a nice investment. It's very cheap.
Yeah, you didn't steal it from her bedazzle kit.
but that's just for the tokens. I mean, if you're talking about things like the talent cards, the action cards, the stance meter, all those sorts of things, you know, they're out there in front of you. You're mm-hmm. not looking up feats in a book. You've got the talents that are slotted into your character, into your career right there. And it's just, from my perspective, you know, I'd see playing Rules Light, which I haven't had a chance to yet, you know, being more detrimental to role playing because you're spending too much time with your nose in the book.
But I think that just allows the people who like to do traditional role playing, as we were called, like a little more math, a little more tables, which are a lot of people, and I'm one of them included, even though I love this other system as well. I still feel like I miss those tables because they're just fun. but one thing I wanted to toss out there for you guys, regarding the bits, Asmodai from the FFG forums, he had posted these great card holders, these nice little organized sets that you could glue a blank card sheet on or card holder onto, and it's you can print out some hardboard, and it actually keeps all your talent cards, your action cards, your character card, and everything all in a nice little like board. And so you can just have all of that thing on one piece of paper, essentially, so you could hold it in your lap, transport it easy. If anybody wants those are on Gitzman's Galleries under the Warhammer Roleplay 3rd Edition resources. And he did a great job. They're like full color artwork and everything. I'd suggest those. They're good fun.
Nice. Cool.
All right, so I think that kind of covers, you know, some of the misconceptions. If you got any more, send them to us. Maybe we'll talk about them in a future episode. But we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to wrap it up with some question and answer. Okay, and we're back. So we're going to wrap things up with some question and answers. Please keep on sending them in to us. We appreciate all that, and hopefully we'll be able to get through all of them in future episodes. So take it away, Jesse.
Sure thing. We've got a question that was sent in directly to the site at the Gmail account from Zwobot, and he asks, should the material limit the player so every hero has a unique action, or is it better to give everybody the choice? And I think what he's referring to here is there are only one copy or one card of each of the actions available in the core set, or in the other sets for that matter, which essentially means that if you have two fighter types in your group, only one of them can have a specific action. There's no doubled up actions. And that's how the game was designed with its kind of initial launch. The core books kind of take that away and allow you to really just cherry pick the ones you want. So should the content limit the players, or should the players be able to choose what they want?
Well, and I think that extends just beyond actions as well, because you've only got one career card, you've only got one, you know, particular focus of, you know, big city spender, things like that. So it goes beyond actions. But, you know, from my perspective, I kind of like the variety. I guess if, you know, you've only got, depending on the size of your group, I mean, I've only got three people playing.
Mm-hmm.
And if I've got two out of the three people that have the exact same talent,
that's gonna get boring.
Real quick. Exact same
maybe.
Action, right? Yeah. And it's gonna be this go-to action kind of thing. So I guess I haven't discouraged it, you know.
But it
I
does encourage players to be a little more versatile.
Yeah,
it does.
I think it makes sense. But you know, if somebody told me, oh, I absolutely should have this action, it doesn't matter that this other player
what
has
does,
it.
What does the rule book say? It says learn to say yes as a GM.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
that's the best piece of advice that book has. If you had nothing else in the GM book, learn to say yes to your players. not unconditionally, but just learn to make them happy to do what they are trying to do, everybody will have a great time. All right, and then from Twitter, we have a question from Fire Broadside. Would be interesting to hear your thoughts on out-of-combat recharge, especially for social actions and support actions.
So I actually, this is a big question from my perspective as well, and there's actually a clarification that isn't in the original core set, but it's in the player's guide. If you actually look on page 71, it has a specific section on recharge in story mode. And they talk about, as a rule of, I'm going to actually just quote it right here, because I think it's a great, I think it's a great way of putting it out there. As a rule of thumb, each time the scene shifts or an event occurs in a story mode, each player should remove one recharge token from each of his recharging actions, talents, conditions, and other recharging cards. Within a given scene or challenge, one round can roughly equate to enough time each player has had to have a chance to act or respond, after which each player may remove one recharge token from each of his recharging cards. So I think it kind of goes back to that whole difference between story mode and encounter mode. If you're in story mode, it's regular, it's free flowing. It's up to the GM. You know, after a certain amount of time passes, whether that's 5 minutes of real time or, you know, a day of real time, you know, enough has gone by, take off a recharge token. If it really gets down to the point where you care about that stuff, when order matters, when timing matters and stuff like that, that's kind of a hint that you should drop into encounter mode and roll for initiative, whether it's social or combat.
Hmm. We've got another question here via our Twitter from Strasa. We switched to using zones from Fate in our game. How do you keep ranges from becoming squares? Is it three maneuvers away?
So what he's talking about there is that the Fate system, when you start an encounter, you actually define particular areas of the encounter and say that each one of these are zones.
So like so this is the edge of the trees, this is in the forest, this is on the road.
Or like, you know, a fight breaks out in the bar. So you've got the common area by the fireplace and behind the bar are those three zones, right? Mm-hmm. So anybody in the same zone is basically, in the Warhammer parlance, is engaged. So you can reach out, you can touch them, you can smack them. So what he's talking about is, you know, he's defining the areas of the encounter as opposed to saying, okay, these guys are close range to these guys who are medium range from these guys, et cetera, et cetera.
So he's trying to do kind of a mix between the two that's a little more detailed.
I think that that's a good way of doing it. You know, honestly, the way that I track all of that stuff is I use stand-ups, and then I use markers for medium, long, and extreme range. I don't use the tokens. I've actually got the Universal Head, his reference, he actually has at the end of that little markers to show medium, long, and extreme range. So if the stand-ups are touching each other, they're engaged. If the stand-ups aren't touching each other but there's no markers, then they're in close range. And then if there's one engagement and another engagement, I put down either a medium, long, or extreme marker in between those to kind of show the distance between them. And that's how I track it, using stands. Okay. So if you're not using stands, I think, you know, it could get a little complex, and maybe something like that zones idea would be a good way of doing it.
Hmm. Well, we've got time for one more question here. Strasa also offers another great question from Twitter. How do you make Chaos Comet Banes from your dice pools fun and interesting in encounters as opposed to just mechanical? And Dan, I think this is a fun one.
I could give him advice for that one. Make him hit a wall. It works all the time.
You know, my favorite one that I've used was when we were doing the Eye for an Eye campaign, and the in the climactic scene where you're fighting the demon and the rest of the cultists up on the roof of the manor. You know, it's raining.
Spoilers.
Yeah, it's a spoiler.
Ooh, spoiler.
I say hopefully that one's a year old now, so we should be okay. One of the guys was I of course added misfortune dice to the roll, any rolls that took place for the weather effects of the rain. I also added a misfortune die for maneuvering on a slanted rooftop. So those two things together helped create a little bit of a detriment to the players. Now, if any of the players were to generate a chaos die while doing a physical action on the near the edge of the roof, they would be in danger of falling off. And then at that point, they'd be making some agility tests to try and catch on. Or maybe they'll fall. And one player ended up, that happened, and he ended up falling off the roof. And, so I forced him to make an agility check to see if he could, you know, catch onto the rim and hold on, or if he would be, begin falling down towards the ground. And he ended up failing his, agility roll. But he did have several boons still attached. So what I helped interpret that is that he did fall. He did not catch the edge of the building, but his cloak ended up getting caught on like a gargoyle or a lamppost midway down, and he's now suspended, kind of hanging. He didn't hurt himself from the fall, but he didn't hang on either.
But he's stuck. Yeah,
he's stuck. Yeah. I mean, it was a kind of fun way to keep it creative and look for something wrong, but also look for something right in a scenario.
Yeah. I think you can kind of summarize that by saying, look at the environment that's around you. And the other thing that I'd add is, you know, as a GM, don't be afraid to give up a little bit of control. You know, all right, you rolled two boons. What does that mean for you? You know, ask the player. Let them do a little storytelling and figure out what they'd like to do. And then you kind of rule on that or tweak it a little bit and say, you know, go forward with it. I think that that's a great way to get your players involved and included as well, is to have them give up a little story control.
Especially the Chaos Stars, because you just say, oh, because everyone's going to go, oh, you got the Chaos Star.
Ooh,
and everyone's
going
to say, like, oh my God, you tripped and fell. Or, oh, dude, you cut your coin purse, and now your coins are scattered all over the floor. Yeah. I mean, they will give you ideas to use, and then you just cherry pick the one that's the most fun.
Yeah, cool. All right, I think that wraps it up. So appreciate everybody listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks with our next episode. Make sure that you comment on the site. We're at recklessdice.rorschach, RORSCHACH.net, or you can send us an email at recklessdice@gmail.com and follow us on Twitter at recklessdice. We're also on iTunes, so feel free to give us a review on there. Thanks for listening, and say goodnight, everybody.
Good night.
Oh, good night, boys.
Which one was that? Was that Australian?
I guess so. I can do Australian. Good night, mate.
Boy.
Boy, a river day, Jake.
I think we're done. All right. Thanks, guys.
Okay.